It's June 15th. We're brought to you by TechGC. And
is today Tupac's birthday or is it tomorrow?
2023.
Hold on. I think it's Tupac's birthday, man. Like, when is
it? Potentially Tupac's birthday, and we're recording this podcast on maybe
tomorrow.
Tupac's birthday
is tomorrow.
The day before Tupac's birthday. The day
before Tupac's birthday. Happy birthday, Tupac.
So here it is.
That's the best TechGC intro.
All right. Here we are.
We're here.
You have a mysterious guy using a weed whacker outside your window. I don't think we need an update.
The mic is picking it up, which is good for the pod, but it's not good for my well-being. There's just like a mysterious subject outside with a weed eater. And he's not really weeding anything because there are no weeds to eat. He's just flailing around with his weed eater and a hat. I don't know, man. You gotta talk to him.
You gotta talk to him after this. Yeah, I gotta know.
Wait till he puts the weed eater down and maybe go out there. And I mean, this is Georgia. Yeah. I don't know if you understand the rules down here, but like, if I talk to him the wrong way, he may shoot me. So I gotta be really careful.
See if we need some water. It's hot out there.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. You know? I'll come with a peace offering and just see if he's okay, because there really is not much for him to do out there, but he's doing it.
Oh man. All right. Well, our guest is Richie Glassberg today. He's the CEO of this company called Safeguard Privacy. I don't know. You knew him before, right?
Yeah, I've known him for a while. He's a good guy, man. He knows his stuff. And one of the things I like is that he's not like he's not a career privacy guy. He's done other interesting things. We're gonna spend most of the time talking about all the other interesting shit he's done, which I think is just as cool, if not cooler, than his time in privacy. But, you know, he came into our space and built a great company with a good product and has been really successful. And I think he provides a framework for being really good at privacy without being obsessed about privacy. And I actually think that's a healthier, much more productive, balanced way to do this job, where the results are improved, where you're not like some kind of fanatical privacy person. The more I've been doing this privacy thing, like, the more put off I am by fanaticism, privacy fanaticism. I really am. And he is the opposite of that. So it's a breath of fresh air, and I'm excited.
You get a lot of practicality coming off of him and people like him. And I think that that's why you see so many, like, as you said, non-100% privacy people are behind some of these companies and actually makes for, in a lot of ways, a better product.
Yeah, some of the companies that are doing the best shit, because they're, you know, and that's what's interesting to me, that like the lesser fanatical, just more like finding a problem to solve type people are just building the better products. They really are, man. They really are. I've seen a lot of, anyway, we don't have to be critical, but I think when I see someone who's got a diverse background, and I mean experience wise specifically here, building a privacy product, I'm always curious, because what I've found historically, and there's other examples besides Richie of doing this, what I've found historically is that they build cool shit, man. They just build good stuff. Mm-hmm. They build good stuff. And they build it and they sell it at a reasonable price, and they have good support, you know, et cetera.
Yep. Amen. I agree with that. All right. Well, so people will like this one. Here's Richie. Yep.
Let's do it.
Here we are.
We're here.
Richie Glassberg is our guest, CEO of Safeguard Privacy. Was just telling a story about how he worked at MTV when they developed YoMTV Raps with Dr. Dre and Ed Lover. Did you get to meet Dr. Dre and Ed Lover?
Oh yeah,
question.
Yeah, we got to meet everybody. It was a young guy named Ted Demme was a associate producer and AP. I was a production manager downstairs. He worked for a guy named Joe Davola. You may know the name because they made a character for his
Seinfeld. 30th.
So his college roommate was a writer on Seinfeld, and for his 30th birthday, his birthday present is they wrote the character Crazy Joe Davola. But we all worked for Joe. He was the producer, and Ted Demme, Jonathan Demme's nephew, had an idea for YoM, wanted to create a rap show. Walked into Freston's office, pitched him the idea. I came up, we made a budget. We shot the pilot for $11,000 at the Palladium. They showed that half hour 20 times in the next month. It was the highest rated show on MTV because it was still music videos. We shot a year's worth for $200,000 at the Palladium. It was incredible. It was 1986. Wow. It was wild. It was amazing.
Yeah, it'd be great to see like MTV reach back at those talented men and compensate them. It'd be, you know, like they literally pioneered like rap entertainment television. $11,000 sounds like they didn't get paid shit, and I don't love that. But you know, at least they got us to break the MTV barrier, because I really think they were pioneers in that way.
You can see them
on my shoulder, so I care about the culture. But like, you know, those guys were pretty formative for me when I was a child.
It was amazing, right? I mean, it was, and $11,000 was what my budget to rent the Palladium and the trucks and do all that. I'll be honest, I don't remember. I don't think anybody got paid. I don't remember what the talent was and how much they paid for that. And Pedro, that's a great question. I was just the production coordinator guy. I was not the talent guy.
Hope they got their due later.
If somebody's listening and they aren't, y'all should be back and pay those guys. They helped your network ride for like 30 years.
You are absolutely right. It was an amazing time.
All right, let's go into your career a little bit, because I don't know if you know this, Richie, but both Pedro and I supported in earlier days in our careers were the main lawyers supporting sales teams. So I have a tremendous love and occasional disdain for the sales team. So let's talk about sales a little bit. I think some people have like a viewpoint on sales that it has to be, a dude selling a used car or trying to get one over on somebody else. That's not been my experience at all. When I worked with folks like that, but you know, that what drove you to think about sales and think about like how to talk to people about software?
So let's take a step back and talk about sales, right? I think everybody's in sales. I think you as lawyers are pitching your ideas. And I will be frank with you guys. When I started in sales at MTV in 87, after I was in production, we didn't have a lawyer on the sales team. So that wasn't a common thing back then. I think all of life is sales. All of life is pitching your ideas and your vision and what you want to accomplish and getting people to come to an agreement on a path forward, no matter what that is, whether it's a contract you're doing or buying software or selling somebody television. And I was lucky enough to grow up under some legendary people. Jerry Laybourne, she founded Nickelodeon, Tom Freston at MTV, Bob Pittman, everybody's boss there. You know, he was selling the idea of music television. And then, you know, I had 9 years under Ted Turner, and Ted would go on sales calls. Ted would come with you with a bag to meet the head of the agency or the client or the person buying cable. And he was selling this concept of cable television versus broadcast television. He was changing the way people thought about what they were doing with their marketing dollars. And so I didn't grow up, Andy, under the car sales point of view. I grew up under the, how do we help solve a problem? How do we create a new industry? I was lucky enough to start my career with people that were literally creating something that didn't exist before. So I do get there's a continuum, Andy, of the car salesman to somebody, you know, selling nuclear non-proliferation, which is very complex and very hard getting everybody to agree on something.
When you go into a sales call with Ted Turner or a CEO or something, you know, as a young person, what does that show you and what does that tell you about sales? Does it, if it were me, I would look at it and say, damn, this is really important. And this person's on this call, or it could tell me something else. I don't know.
It could go either way with Ted, depending on the day, to be frank with you guys.
Not him specifically necessarily, you know, but just anybody, CEOs. You're
from
Atlanta.
I want to hear
right?
about Ted Turner.
All right.
Ted was legendary. Ted had no filter. But Ted understood that the head of the agency had been buying television a certain way, and Ted's job was to convince her that cable television mattered. And we, look, Pittman, Harvey Gano, the legendary Bob Rigani, all these people at MTV and Turner. You have to think back. Think back to early days internet. Think back to when a buyer only bought three broadcast networks. And the world I grew up in was a world of consultative selling. It was alternative ratings. We talk about that now, but it was why cable versus broadcast. It was reach and frequency curves. It was highly complex. And then it came down to gut, and it came down to explaining to people how they could broaden their message and reach a wider audience. But Ted, I mean, Pedro, it could go off the rails really quickly when you went on a sales call with Ted. He knew everybody. I mean, he from the very beginning, don't forget, he had a UHF station after his father, you know, committed suicide, and he inherited this station, and there was just HBO up on the satellite. And he had this idea to take this little UHF, put it on the satellite, battle the legal rules against, it was very complex about retransmission rights, blah, blah, blah. And he just had this vision. And then you think about somebody with vision. Not only did he create the cable television model, the dual revenue stream, he came up with the idea of 24-hour news. That was very different from the world we grew up with. Your parents and I, we saw news at 6:30 on whatever, BAL in Baltimore, Andy. And
yeah.
Then, you know, then there was the CBS News or the NBC. Your family was on NBC News, right? You had choices, right? So we were literally trying to change decades of behavioral patterns. So it was a really cool world to grow up in. In a challenge, and MTV was amazing. And then they convinced me to leave MTV and go to Turner because the legendary people running that, I was just incredibly lucky, right place. You know, I worked hard, kept my head down. And they convinced me that I needed to be in a more broad based, I was selling teens, and it was a great advice. It was like, hey, you got to learn to sell more. And when you're in the allure of something that hot, you're like, oh, this is what I'll do the rest of my life. And it was a very foundational lesson that you have to broaden your base, right? When you start your career, you have to build that great foundation so that you can do multiple different things down the road. So it was a big deal when I left MTV and went to Turner. People were like, why are you doing that?
It sounds like Ted Turner was an informative and dynamic and amazing figure. I'm curious, Pedro, what's his sort of legacy in Atlanta?
Ted Turner is a major figure in the city. I mean, he's got a restaurant chain all throughout the city, his connection with the Braves, his connection with Turner. I mean, CNN, like, yeah. There's streets named after this man, and there's restaurants with his name on it everywhere you turn. So he is a big figure. He's also a tremendous philanthropist in town. You know, there's a lot of stuff going on with Ted Turner's legacy in Atlanta, and I think he's interwoven with the city, man, like in a cool way.
Is he responsible for like the growth of that city in terms of economics and
I mean, I don't
business
know that he's solely responsible, but he's definitely a big figure. I mean, we've got the Atlanta's an interesting city because sometimes it's easy to overlook the fact that there's like some pretty major corporations here, right? So like you think of Ted and all his conglomerates, but you also think of Coca-Cola, you think of Home Depot, you think of Delta, just to name a couple. There's a bunch.
Yeah.
So like the city's got like really interesting like legacy families. I don't know if that's the right terminology, but like that are still and remain super involved in the city's development. Ted is one of those people for sure, though.
Yeah, it seems like he's very responsible for. Yeah,
I don't think there's any real I'm not from Atlanta. I live here and have lived here for 5 years, but I don't think there's a single person who lives in Atlanta that doesn't know who Ted Turner is, right? Like that's just not a thing.
Yeah, it's like. I think a lot of cities have that. I'm trying to think of who it would be in Baltimore, Richie. Maybe it's Cal Ripken.
Yeah. And whenever you drive down there and you see the facility on 95, right? Hey, Nancy Pelosi's family, you know, yeah. Whether your father mayor, there's a lot mm-hmm. of, there's a lot of that in there.
You mentioned a lot of people in those two jobs, like MTV and Turner, as you went through, you mentioned a lot of people. And one thing that weaves its way through, not just your career, but Pedro's and mine and I think lots of people, is relationships and how critical relationships are. And I think, you know, getting to know you over the last few years, is very obvious to me that you have a strong point of view on making relationships and how those serve you personally and in a business capacity, that it's not just like, hey, I just want to get a deal done. No, it's an actual relationship. So I know you've thought about this, but I'm curious to know, you know.
So I think mentorship is one of the most important things. It's hard, but I think people lose sight that you got a break because somebody took a break on you. That, you know, think about, you know, I listened to some of your podcasts. Pedro, you were talking about that partner at your first firm who really wasn't in tech, but he influenced you and all these other associates. I think, you know, Andy, you've got that person in your life. I was lucky to have mentors who taught me how to work and taught me what business was. And they pushed me, and they were mentors that said, I helped you, now you have to help others. So I learned in a different way. And I think that what worries me about the world we're in now, and I love the fact that we can work anywhere, and I love all that. What worries me is, how does the next generation of people that come into corporations understand that this is all relationships, that nothing ever goes right? You know, there's no deal that you guys have worked on that everything goes right. You have to have a relationship with the opposing counsel or the other lawyer or the other company. You've got to be able to say, I'm sorry, I screwed up. You got to be able to have that relationship to know. And I think it's more than just your work. It's the stuff you do in the industry. What you guys do for TechGC, my entire legal team listens to every one of your podcasts. I don't listen to all of them, but I listen to a lot of them. But you're giving a service so that you have this reputation. And I think all that is this fabric of what is a relationship is. What are you doing for the industry? What are you doing for your company? What are you doing for the world to make things better? And that all becomes the fabric of who you are. Because there is not one deal, one thing you do that's going to go perfect every step of the way. And all you have is that reputation and the trust factor of what people who know you. And even if it's a new deal, Andy and Pedro, when you go into a new deal and you don't know the person, they look at your LinkedIn and they say, wow, okay, I got the connection. I can call this one. I can call that one. I can check on the person, because nobody knows everybody. But you want to have that fabric that people can touch you and say, this is a trustworthy person. I can try to do a partnership with this person.
Yeah, I'll tell you what. I hear the importance of connection and understanding and people knowing each other. I think some of this talk out there in the world, particularly by old guard, about the need for deep isn't even the word, for relationships and how the office cultivates that, is a bunch of garbage to me, man. Like, I've been remote for 10 years. That's more than half of my career so far. I have a lot of great relationships, and I haven't had to be in an office. And I think this myth that, like, the way to build relationships is to be in person in offices is sort of like what's the word I'm looking for? Like, sort of like rear guard, maintain exclusivity sort of methodology, which worked in the past, right? Like, if you were a male, a working male with a stay-at-home wife, and you left the house for 12 hours a day, and you became super chummy with your other male counterparts and played golf and went to dinner and did all these things and lived the Mad Men life, sure, you had deep relationships, and sure, that lubricated, you know, the ability to close deals and advance business. I don't know that that's the right way to do that, though. You know, like, that's like a lame exclusive way to do that. So, like, I actually think the next generation, Generation Z, generation whatever the fuck we're calling people now, I don't know, these kids are actually going to teach us a new way to do this, which emphasizes expertise, knowledge, and know-how over who my buddies are, who I hang out with, who I have the most chummy relationship in the, you know, like, water cooler at the job. And I think that's actually good for business, not bad for business. We'll have to see. But one thing I'm certain of is that it's going to allow a lot more people into the conversation. Like, the single mom who has to work from home because she's got to be near her kid's school, the person with disabilities who can't commute to the office every day and do the hangout thing because they've got to go see a doctor, whatever, man. Like, it's just going to allow brains to dominate instead of personalities. And I think that's a good thing.
You know what else helps this is the rise of communities. So Tech GC as an example, we didn't have these types of communities that are virtual. And then you can show up to an event, you know, Pedro, we do a lot of our meetups and bonding and stuff around IPP and other events. Like you do have to be intentional about getting to know people, but you're absolutely right. Like take away the everydayness and the staleness of that one way of doing things. And there's if we're thoughtful about it and we try, there's lots of new ways to establish relationships. And I agree with you. They're going to be more like dynamic.
Yeah. I think it's extremely uncreative to be like, well, the old way of doing things is dying. Now we're going to be lesser than. Like, I just don't think so. There's just so many new types of people and new ideas in business that we can create new connections. We can create new, archetypes of how it is best to optimize like your output at work. And I don't think it has to include a 2-hour drive at my own expense every day through hell to get to an office to then be on Zoom all day in an empty corporate building. Like that just,
Richie, you have a remote company, right?
Oh, I totally agree with both of you guys. You're both 100% right. I was just making the point that to learn this, how do we now do what my point was? My question to both of you is, how do we now teach mentorship to the next generation? I don't want to be in an office, Pedro. You're 100% right. Do you know how many times I got on a plane and flew somewhere in the world and the person I was going to meet with had a problem and they had to say, look, I only got 5 minutes. And you're like, really? This really sucks.
I just flew across the fucking ocean.
Right? It's stupid. Right now, I can do 8 Zooms in a day. And as long as your camera's on and the person, I don't mind if the person says, hey, I got a problem. Can we reschedule this? When you flew on a plane, it was dumb, Pedro. It was a waste of time, effort. It just killed your body. You guys are 100% right. But the theme through all this is what you asked, Andy, is how do you make relationships? How do you have the trust? How do you have, and I was pointing to what you're doing with this Tech GC and with this podcast is people have to know you. They have to know your background. They have to know what you've done. They have to understand what you can bring to the table. And Pedro, you're 100% right. You can have the best relationships in the world. You can't sell a bad product. I don't care what anybody tells you. You cannot sell a bad product. And you cannot, if you don't have the skills, you can just be relationships. It's not going to give you anything in the world. You're not going to be, I don't know. That's hard to say.
It's going
to
fuck up your relationships is what's going to happen.
Right. You can't sell the one truism of sales is don't sell somebody something they don't need. You just can't do that. You'll never be successful in sales. You may make that sale once, you will not make it a second time. You will not have the trust. You will not have the network. Because you know what? Everybody calls somebody this world, Andy, networks are huge. The network effect is huge. If I don't know somebody, they're gonna call somebody and say, hey, do you know Richie? And if the person says, yeah, you sold me something I don't need, you're dead, right? I was on a call with a major company with 10 lawyers, and I'm not a lawyer. I'm in with this whole world of lawyers pitching a product, which I've never sold to lawyers. It is so hard. I need the two of you to help me be a therapy session. But I'm there, and this one lawyer out of the four is just pounding me, and I'm doing my best. I'm saying, look, this is all I can do. This is what we're doing. And after 20 minutes, the guy says to me, yeah, well, I called this lawyer. She was over here and she bought you and she said you were okay. I just wanted to make sure. And I was like, I got pounded before the person admitted to me that he back checked me with somebody else. So, you know, the network is there and sometimes you don't see it. If you don't have the skill set, if you're not good at what you do, if you try to sell somebody something they don't need, you'll never get there because the back channel will kill you.
I think that even goes beyond software. Literally,
just you want to talk about things that'll kill
someone,
you?
BS, right?
Don't sell them. You want to talk about things that'll kill you? There is a fucking random dude in my front yard right now with a weed eater going bananas. I don't even have a lawn. I don't know what's happening. I don't know if you guys can hear that, but it sounds like a chainsaw, but it's a weed eater, and I don't
understand why
this is. Is this the weed eater killer in Atlanta? Are you being spotted by the weed eater?
Do you have a relationship with him?
I'm about to have a relationship he doesn't like with him, because I'm going to go on mute and tell him to get the fuck out of here.
It's not, you don't have a lawn service?
I don't have a lawn. I mean, there's like a garden way over there, but he's like waving and he's like bobbing around with this weed eater. I don't know what's going on out here.
Andy and I will be witnesses in the Pedro weed eater death trial.
That's crazy. Can you, Maybe we should pause the podcast to go talk to him.
No, no, keep going, man. Let's see how this plays out. I want evidence right. on this one.
Here's my next question for you, Richie.
Yeah.
You started this company in privacy tech. Well, it's like crazy space that's changing all the time as the GDPR, the CCPA, like passed overnight. Like, why'd you pick privacy? You could have picked any number of businesses to start.
I'm insane. What the hell was I thinking? It's just, I think my ADD reached up and caught me in a weak moment, right? No. Look, I came out of, I'm just, you know, I've been lucky enough to be in this space since 95. I've been a publisher head, a network head, an agency head, an ad tech head. And I've seen all sides of this. And I'm just fascinated. I believe this is just a fundamental change in our society. I believe that, you know, the internet, you know, I actually believe companies want to do the right thing. And I think the internet is just an amazingly, you know, transformative change for our society. There's a lot of good, there's a lot of bad, right? We could go on that sort of its own podcast. And I love it. And I love being here. And I've done a lot for the industry with the IAB and the companies I've been at. And I came out of, I had pivoted MediaLets, which was the mobile site ad server. One day Google woke up in 2014 and said, oh, mobile's a thing. We were selling mobile ad serving at 3 cents a thousand. They said, oh, Dart's an ad server. Even though it's web-based, it's a quarter of a cent. And they literally wiped out 150 companies. It was crazy. And we survived, but we ended up selling it to WPP to be the ad server back there in that device graph. And I was stuck there for 2 years, and I spent 2 years fixing a lot of stuff in the back as a WPP subsidiary CEO. And when I came out, I had a different context as I'd never been on the agency side. When I came out in 2018, I looked at GDPR and don't laugh at me, guys. I looked at the IAPP fact book and my view on GDPR was it was a direct relationship that programmatic advertising forgot the consumer. And I'm not a lawyer, but I read it as a law going after marketers because it was, do you have data on a consumer? And I know GDPR has got the human, but I was focusing on the other part. And I looked at the IAPP fact book in early 2018. There was 120 companies and not one of them came from ad tech. I'm like, who are these people? I'm like, how are they going to fix this? This is so complex. I've been in it. I don't even know shit in ad tech. And my original idea was to come up with an assessment for GDPR for ad tech. And I wasn't a lawyer and I knew I needed a lawyer. So it took me 4 months. A mutual CEO put me in touch with Wayne Mattis, my co-founder. And guys, he was a lawyer. You know, he founded the privacy practice at St. Leans, which became Denton's, and he founded and led the privacy practice at Pillsbury and Winthrop. And he's an old dude, but he's doing privacy forever. I mean, how crazy is it that when I was at CNN.com, Jules Polonetsky was a double click, 1990, and I knew him from 98. In 1999, my co-founder, Wayne Mattis, and Jules Polonetsky did the first CLE for the New York City Bar on privacy. I didn't, you know, and then all these years later, I hook up with Wayne. And Wayne then became, for the 7 years before I hired him, he became in-house, right? He went from the law firm to in-house. He became the managing director of UBS, in charge of the senior lawyer for all compliance globally. So he had to deal with GDPR for those 7 years and money laundering and everything else. And when I met him, they had restructured. He didn't want to move to Switzerland. He said, Richie, you know, you've got like only a lawyer would. He goes, Richie, that's a nice idea, but it's only about three quarters of a good idea. Let me tell you what the right idea is. And he gave me chapter and verse that there wasn't a legal compliance platform for privacy. And there is in lots of other laws, in FINRA and securities and right. So he literally, I just built his vision of a lawyer that had been at a law firm for hundreds of companies and had been in-house on something that didn't exist. And I didn't know how crazy I was and I didn't realize how hard this was. And I, you know, as a lot of entrepreneurs, I just thought this was a good idea. And it's been a...
But you had the advantage of seeing OneTrust and seeing TrustArc, right? I mean, there were a couple companies in the, at least the adjacent space, right? So they certainly, no one's going to dispute OneTrust had first mover advantage on privacy.
Absolutely, but they're not from ad tech. Kabir wasn't from ad tech.
That's right. No. Right.
Now, you could argue that TrustArc, which was trustee, you know, there were some people there, right? I'm not, But for the most part, and I did look at it, and I didn't want to do those companies. I don't compete with those guys. They got 10 tools. You buy, you know, I don't compete with any of them. And our original product, we really didn't compete with anybody. When we launched in 2020, after 2 years of building, Bank of America asked us to build vendor compliance. I do compete with Vendorpedia, which is more like a TPRM GRC thing. But even that, there isn't a lot of people doing in the IEPP factbook. So I was taking a different tact.
Do you struggle? Do you struggle, Richie, with like who's the buyer? I hear this a lot. Horrible. I hear this a lot from it's privacy horrible. Tech companies that. You know, the GC, is GC the buyer? Is the CPO the buyer? Is it both of them? Is it the CTO? Is it the head of engineering?
Andrew, Pedro, I talk to everybody, right? Because the other thing about my company is I'm agnostic. I don't care what tool you use to get compliant. You may build your own CMP. You may buy one from Big ID, Transcend, OneTrust. All my clients are OneTrust, TrustArc, Big ID, every single one of them, because I don't do that stuff. So I talk to everybody. Everybody I talk to says the biggest single problem is this is like InfoSec 15 years ago, before there was a CISO, before the CTO or the CISO had a budget for this stuff, right? So you talk. I was just for the last 3 days at Jules Polonetsky's FPF with 80 CPOs, and a lot of them don't have a budget. So then, you talk to them and then they send you to the CTO who's got a budget, or the IT team who's got a budget, or the CISO or the GC. It is so hard right now. It feels like it was 15, 20 years ago in InfoSec, where there isn't that budget owner. And
how does Meta do that? Pedro, how does Meta do that? They got to have budget for privacy tools.
But don't you build your own stuff, Pedro?
Or are they just building their own always and there's
Can
no...
Can we not talk about how Meta does it?
Sorry, I didn't bring it up, Pedro. It was Andy. It wasn't me.
I know, Andy, leave me alone.
I didn't do Salesforce. It.
We're not going to talk about how Meta does it, but I will say that Meta invests very aggressively and intentionally in our privacy program, and I would argue we have the best one on Earth because we have the most resources, the smartest people, and the best partnership.
Right.
How's that?
So, Pedro, you are bringing up a really important point, right? You guys are trying to do the right thing. You, Google, Amazon, you've got the resources. I go into companies that aren't your size, and they're like, help me. I don't have the resources. I have to be compliant with now 10 laws in the U.S. Now you got Washington State with the sensitive data, and you've got private right of action. If they're global, then they're worried about, you know, GDPR and others. And one of the biggest problems I hear from people is I don't have the resources. I'm not one of the big five. And does, you know, Andy, to your point, does the CEO really get it? And here's something that I'll bring up. I talk to people and I'm like, well, nobody's been fined yet. The only people being fined are the big guys. They're not coming after me. And they're having trouble explaining to their CEO why they have to do this. And that's a problem for OneTrust, TrustArc, Big ID, everybody out there.
There's another angle. Like, enforcement is one stick, but there are carrots, like sales, right? Like, if you can use your privacy program as a market differentiator with your customers, you can land whales, okay? You're a startup and you need to land a big logo. Well, show them you have you've made investments in privacy protection and in a privacy program. Like, of course, you're not going to be able to, you know, as a small startup with limited resources, you know, show them the Cadillac suite of options. But like having a meaningful, good faith, robust investment in an area that is high risk for your customers is important. Like, just that alone, I think, is a good enough reason, not the enforcement risk. And I also will say this, yes, like in Europe and in the United States, the regulators have to pick and choose their battles and they always come for big logos and that's never going to change. But I'm watching a trend of them coming for some small logos, particularly where there's egregious action or negligence or there's just like no attempt at compliance. And so like not doing anything is definitely not a formula for success.
You are 100% right. Now, look, it's a nuanced, cohort, right? If you're a compliance-led industry, if you're in pharma, if you're in insurance, if you're in financial, a lot of our early clients are there because if you have a compliance-led background, you're going to want to do the right thing, Pedro. You're absolutely right. I mean, you know, and I'm allowed to talk. I can't talk about most of our clients, but Bank of America has been very open about this. They're a compliance-led organization, and they wanted to do vendor compliance in this in 2020 before the CPRA said you have a legal obligation to do this. So when you're a compliant, I give them tons of credit. You know, it came from the CMO at the time and the data governance team, and they, Pedro, they publicly are using that. I think you're absolutely right that it's a market differentiator. We've got two of the biggest, you know, credit bureau places that aggregate data from, you know, 700 data sources that in July are going to announce that their data marketplaces are fully transparent. I think that's a marketing play. I think that's a really strong message.
Agreed.
In a confusing ecosystem. And I love that, Pedro. You're 100% right on that.
Yeah, I agree with you. Obviously.
Right? It's complicated out there, right?
Can I give everyone an update on my weed eater situation?
Yeah, what's going on?
It is developing, okay? So he's now sitting on my staircase. The weed eater is on, but he's resting. I have no idea what's happening. I don't know why he's here.
Andy, I have a question. Does he have a hockey mask on?
No. No, he does not. He is wearing eyeglasses. He seems like a really nice guy. I'm just not sure why he's out here, man. But God bless him. God bless him.
I love he seems like a nice
he's
guy.
He's like a super nice guy. Like if he knocked on my door, I'd probably open it. But
maybe you offer him some lemonade.
Yeah.
It's hot out there.
I'll do it after the show. I'm on it.
So I was listening to, I was catching up on some of your podcasts. I was listening to Andy Wood from PubMatic, the poker player, and I was fascinated by the conversation. And when he was talking about the two types of poker players, you know, the gut, and then it's now shifted to the algorithmic, I think that's what our industry has done, right? If you think about this, all this current media hype about ChatGPT and all that, we've had algorithms in our business for a long time. We've had versions of AI, optimization, programmatic advertising. And when I listened to him, I was thinking, Pedro, when I was listening to your guys' conversation, the advertising marketplace has now gone to this whole quant-based programmatic. And I think these privacy laws are making it hard for everybody to be compliant. And that, you know, that complexity has changed the tenor of everything we're doing. Right. It's changed how people sell in our marketplace. It probably changed your roles as lawyers to sales teams in the marketplace. Right. You know, Andy, when you ask about what sales, even if you're selling programmatic, you have to go in and explain the benefits to the end user, whether it's the agency or the CMO or whoever's doing this. And I'm really concerned about the regulators' inability to understand the actual underpinnings. And I'm worried about a bunch of things like, they're breaking measurement, and CMOs today are all measured on KPIs, and they're measured on, you know, it's not just did they sell more dandruff shampoo, it's all the KPIs on their media spend. And there's so many implications to these laws that are just, I think, are going to have tremendous short-term turmoil on our industry. And then, you know, I don't really know where it's going to go and how we're going to solve some of these issues.
Yeah. I mean, until the U.S., at least in the U.S., until there's harmony, that would be nice, be helpful to have one regime to look at that hopefully was not written with one industry that it's, you know, potentially focused on impacting more than another. I don't know if that'll happen or if we'll get that. In the U.S., we may just get multiple state laws and we have to harmonize them ourselves. The GDPR is a different, as we see more states being developed, I think I'd like to hear from you guys on this. And this is coming right out of my daily work. As we see more states come out with laws and you have to interpret these different state laws. And then when you try to tie a concept or a privacy position that you're going to take in the US to the GDPR, I feel like it's becoming increasingly difficult to find a scenario where you can take a position across the US and the GDPR. People still have to do it. So I think there's going to be
difficulty. But why do we have to do it?
I don't know. Maybe we don't. Maybe I'm wrong.
I don't think you can. Like, you'd be lying if you said, here's my global privacy strategy and it complies with all laws. That's not possible. Well, maybe it's possible in some businesses. It's definitely not possible in a global ad tech company, right? Like, that's just not a thing. So you do have to take regional approaches, and that can mean different things. It can mean we curate to regional requirements. It could mean we don't participate in this market because this market isn't compatible with our global strategy.
I think it's actually even more layered than that, Pedro. I think it's like regional and use case. So you actually it's almost like a cube, right? Like the diagram is three-dimensional, use case by use case, jurisdiction by jurisdiction, and then maybe even like drill down a layer deeper. Pick your poison.
Pedro, you know better than anybody, right? Nobody's ever going to be 100% compliant, and you got to risk mitigate. And the question is, are you going to think about your ad spend in Europe differently? They think about the ad spend for Unilever differently in India than they think about it in the US and they think about it in Latin America. You know, there's no universal code of how people do advertising. So I think you have to do the same thing on what you're looking at to your privacy compliance. They sell sachets of soap for a couple of pennies. And in India, there for years, one of the innovations was doing ringtones on phones in trade for stuff. It's a different world when you look at advertising globally. It's not as simple as people think it is.
I agree with everything you just said. Yeah, and I also think like the cost of an ad is going to vary by market, depending on how risky it is to deliver the ad in the market. Like if I'm Toyota and I build cars, I charge a little bit more when I sell a car in California, and I charge a little bit more when I sell a car in Europe. And it's not for shits and giggles. It's because it costs more to sell a car there. Like, I mean, you got to do different things to the fucking car. I don't know why an advertisement would be any different. That's my personal take. Obviously, you want to sell the best ad you can for the lowest price you can. That gives you the ability to sell to the most people. But if there are regulatory and delivery constraints in a market, well, an ad's going to have to cost more there in that market. And then to your point, advertisers are going to have to figure out how to spend their dollars. It's just what it is.
And markets are different. When we were selling, you know, an ad server, we were the first mobile ad server, and the holding companies use us around the world. And we would have an MSA, right, with whatever, you name the one, I can't name them. And the agency in Vietnam would say, Richie, I can't pay the 3 cents a thousand ad serving for mobile. My premium content is 50 cents. If I have to pay 3 cents, it's too much. In the US, if premium content is $10, you can charge 3 cents for ad serving, right? So it's not just the regulatory, it's also the markets. If the media costs less, what are you going to sell? What's a premium ad in Vietnam at 50 cents versus the US at $10? That rolls through the whole ecosystem of the ad tech tax, what's happening out there, the data you can buy. It's incredibly complicated as you go market to market. And Pedro, to your point, does the car cost different? Does the product cost different? Do you sell it in a different formula? Nothing is the same globally. So I think you have to look at the privacy laws differently as well.
All right, last question, Richie. One of the aspects I love about sales is expensive dinners and trips. And what's the craziest one you've seen or been to? And I have a story too, but let's hear yours.
Look, I was lucky enough. I've been lucky enough to be in sales and leadership for a long time. And I've just been lucky to be able to do really cool things. I will say in my career, I only had 3 years in sports. So there's two things I'll give you. So 3 years, I ran Speed Channel for News Corp. Let me tell you, I could call any CEO in the world, and say, hey, the AMA Superbikes is at Laguna Seca this weekend, and I have the track for the day beforehand. Do you want to come drive the new Cayenne SUV? And do you want me to put you in a car and you can drive the track? And they'd be like, or I'd say, hey, Daytona's coming up, and I've got Daytona for 2 days before the 500. Do you want to get in a car and drive? I could have a CEO who has a earnings call that day would say, move the earnings call. I mean, you called any CEO, male, female in the world and say, hey, I got the Nürburgring. I've got Silverstone. You know, the race is here. We've got on Wednesday, you can come get on the track and drive a car. They would drop anything and get, you would not believe the people we put in cars at Laguna Seca, at Talladega. People like to drive cars and go fast. You know, I took 20 agency heads to Lime Rock up in Connecticut because it was close. Wasn't even a race. And all we did was have a day where they got to drive the Formula 3 cars, drive on the skid pad, drive a Viper. And we had mortal enemies in suits in their underwear, putting their flame suits on, laughing like little kids. It was awesome. And they would just do anything. And there was a CEO of an agency, and we had a pro. We were on the Vipers, and we had this guy driving the Viper on, and he actually got it airborne and backwards, and he was screaming, and the professional driver's reaching over and grabbing the steering wheel. I'm like, oh, if I kill one of these guys, they're going to just be so mad at me at News Corp. You can get anybody to go anywhere. I did like 12 Super Bowls, and everybody does Super Bowl trips and all that. But my clients, I was running Gemstar TV Guide. It was advanced television and data and internet and all this crazy stuff. And my clients, we used to go Super Bowl and go to golf. And my clients in the 2006 Super Bowl was in Detroit, and nobody wanted to go to Detroit. So they all convinced me to go to Vegas. So I took 16 people, male and female, to Vegas. We played Shadow Creek on Friday. But I hired Phil Gordon on Friday night, and I convinced News Corp to let me do this. I made everybody put in $200 of their own, and I got the poker tables at the Wynn. It had just opened, and they roped it off. And we had 16 clients, five of us, so we had about 20 people. We gave everybody $10,000 of real chips, and we had Phil Gordon, the professional poker guy, and we did a poker tournament. Now, it was not real money, but it was the real chips. So they had security and stuff. And all these people thought it was a real tournament. And they saw Phil Gordon. So we had a crowd like 5 or 10 deep. And we took the $200 from everybody. We made everybody do that. And we paid out the winners. And I had one sales guy. We paid out the top four with their own buy-ins, right? And I had one sales guy left. And I'm just saying, just fucking bust out. You can't have a sales guy win. And he busted out in fifth and four of the clients. And we did that. So that was fun. And the next day I hired Bob May, and it was right after he had taken a couple years after he'd taken Tiger to overtime in the PGA, and he lived out there, and I hired him, and he did the coolest thing that anybody's ever done. He said to me, he showed up, we paid him a lot of money to come play a round of golf with people, and, you know, got four holes with him. Really nice guy. And the night before, he called his ping rep, and he had a bag in his garage. And back then, he had 16 of the exact same ping drivers. And he said, look, I called my rep. Can I? One of those was the driver he used for all 4 days with Tiger Woods. So he asked permission. He signed all 16, and he walked up, and he said, look, guys, one of these is the one. They're all identical. I've signed them all. You can all honestly say, luck of the draw, you may have the driver I played with Tiger Woods. And he gave every one of our clients one of those drivers. That was kind of fun, you know, but, you know, people do a lot more fun stuff than I've ever done. I just did boring stuff.
That sounds so boring.
And you can't, yeah, you can't tell really the stories.
I'm sorry MTV. You had to go through that.
Yeah, well, I'm sorry.
Really, well, we had a lot of fun at MTV. That was like, you know, we did the first spring breaks. We brought clients out. That was insane. But
I went to a couple MTV spring breaks in Key West.
You did?
Fuck yeah. Dude.
What year?
Man, it was early 2000s. So like early
2000s. No,
I wasn't dancing.
Were you on the show where they go on the bus and they go on a date?
I wasn't on any fucking shows, but I was there for MTV spring break and did all of the like adjacent festivities, which I will never speak of, but they were wildly transformative.
So Pedro, I got a trivia question for you. So I was 23, 24. I was the production manager on the very first spring break ever, 1986 at Penrod's in Daytona Beach. Joe DeVol was the producer, right? Who was the very first act on the Budweiser concert stage for the very first spring break?
1984,
ever?
You said?
86. Yes. It was 1986.
The first in 86. I don't know.
Guns N' Roses.
No, but that's a good guess. It's more up Pedro's alley than yours, though. I'm
LL Cool J.
Dude, he was the most awesome human being. Now,
I feel like he was at the top of the game around that era, maybe right after. But, man, Ice-T, I'm trying.
It was the Beastie Boys.
Okay, the Beastie Boys is good. The Beastie Boys is good.
It was the Beastie Boys. The very first spring break, the very first headliner band on the Budweiser concert stage at Penrod's.
Shout out to the Beastie Boys.
Dude, we did everything wrong. It was the first spring break. We went down for a site survey 2 weeks before. It was all sunshine. We did everything wrong. We got there, it rained for 5 days. We had no contingencies. I mean, live TV at MTV was insane back then. It was why I did every live show from Live Aid until Amnesty, and then I begged them to get into sales, and the production people thought, Davola, Doug Herzog, they all thought I was out of my mind. I was like, no, I was a kid. I want to be in sales. I was an idiot.
I love this, Richie. The journey we've described in this podcast goes from Daytona Beach rocking out with the Beastie Boys to running a privacy compliance software company. Yeah. The chasm between those things is unbelievable.
But Andy, that's the beauty of life. You have no idea where the path is going to take you, right? I mean, you have no idea.
And it just shows that to be successful at things, you don't have to be fanatical. Like, you don't have to be a psychopath, privacy absolutist to be great at privacy. And, like, that to me is the best lesson of your career and of many of the folks that come on this podcast, which is, like, we try to highlight the things about them that aren't what they're doing at their desk, just to sort of show that, like, the best privacy practitioners have a wide renaissance-like variety of interests that make them better at their jobs. Not that they hyper-focus on one thing and that's all they care about 24 hours a day. I think that's a shitty practitioner.
You have to be curious.
Yeah, man.
You have to be curious. You have to say, well, why is this? I was like, why are these laws coming? This is going to break marketing. How do I fix this? Yeah,
and also, how do these things interplay with everything else? Because this is not a singular in a vacuum issue. But anyway. That's another
podcast. Look, I don't know. I'm not a lawyer, guys. I was dyslexic and ADHD. They would have shot me in law school, right? You know, and I don't forget, when I'm older than you guys, when I grew up, the only exposure I had to law, other than my dad was a great lawyer, but different thing is my dad, you know, right? But I watched The Paper Chase where the old dude just yelled at you. I was like, I thought that was law school. Yeah. And I hated school because, you know, I was ADD, you know, dyslexic. I mean, it was hard enough to get through school and then RPI and engineering school. I was like, law school? That shit would kill me. Or they would kill me. Or I would kill
them. Law school's not that hard and it's not that interesting. I know lawyers try to act like law school. If you're a fancy lawyer and the hardest thing you've ever done in your life is go to law school, you haven't done hard things.
I love it. Newsflash.
So I think you would have been just fine, champ.
Richie, we gotta let you go. We gotta go. But this
thank
has been
you
fun.
So
really
much
fun.
For having me. What you guys are doing, it informs so many people. It's amazing the guests you have on. I learned some. I wish I had time to listen to everyone, but I will say to people out there, when you watch an episode, you learn something in every episode. It's amazing.
Thanks, man.
You guys are doing. I really appreciate the effort you're making to make this demystified for everybody out there.
Appreciate that, man.
Yeah. Thanks. We're trying to have fun.